Welcome to Hope Solo Speaks. I am extremely honored to have a conversation today with a man who has never been afraid to take a stand. Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf was one of the best NBA players and most feared shooters 25 years ago. Shaquille O'Neal described that watching him play was like watching God himself play basketball. Mahmoud was one of the most popular ball players of his generation, drafted number 3 overall in the 1990 NBA draft. He played 7 seasons of nearly flawless basketball for the Denver Nuggets before sparking controversy, and which ultimately led to his ousting inside of 2 years. Mahmoud refused to stand for the national anthem and called the U.S. flag a symbol of oppression. The current day protests from athletes all over the world are well known. Current NBA stars like LeBron James and Chris Paul are continually speaking out on social justice reforms. The stark difference being that Mahmoud was not afforded these same luxuries when he played in the 90s. Taking a stand for what he believed and still believes was an exercise of religious freedom and personal conviction. The very concepts that the American flag are supposed to represent. Abdul-Rauf's peaceful protests were less known, almost completely villainized by fans and media, and never celebrated. Abdul-Rauf's stance against the national anthem led to poverty, depression, unemployment, his home being burned to the ground, and divorce. Yet he refused to be defined by the sport he played. It is long overdue, nearly 3 decades later, for the world to hear his story, to see his courage, and to recognize that he was one of the most inspiring athletes and men of our time. He is currently promoting his new Showtime sports documentary, Stand, a raw and unflinching examination of the courageous and remarkable life of basketball star and social justice activist Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf. The feature-length documentary details Abdul-Rauf's unprecedented journey from schoolboy prodigy to NBA all-rookie team to national pariah. In terms of his athletic abilities and activism, he was Steph Curry before Steph Curry and Colin Kaepernick before Colin Kaepernick. Stand includes the voices of some of the biggest names in sports and entertainment, with 4-time NBA champion and NBA Finals MVP Steph Curry, 9-time NBA champion as player and coach Steve Kerr, NBA Hall of Famer and 3-time NBA Finals MVP Shaquille O'Neal, former NBA player and current basketball analyst Jalen Rose, 2-time Oscar-winning actor Mahershala Ali, and rapper, actor, and filmmaker Ice Cube. Stand premieres this Friday, February 3rd at 9 p.m. Eastern on Showtime. Stand is the feature-length directorial debut of Jocelyn Rose Lyons, and she believes that this project is important because of the many fires Abdul-Rauf had to walk through. It is my absolute honor to bring to you today both Jocelyn Rose Lyons and Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf. Mahmoud, Jocelyn, thank you for being here on Hope Solo Speaks today. Thank you and your team for allowing me to get a sneak peek into this new documentary coming out called Stand, which is coming out this Friday on Showtime. Now, I'm not going to spoil it for everybody, but it is incredibly, incredibly powerful beyond words. So I'm very excited to get your story out there, Mahmoud. I first want to ask you, you're a little bit on a media tour right now, and I just was informed that this is your last interview of the day. I don't consider myself media. I don't side myself with the other side. I like to have a conversation, athlete to athlete. How are you doing? Are you exhausted telling the same stories? I mean, emotionally exhausted, reliving every moment of your life.
Yeah, well, I'm not quite at the point of exhaustion, but yeah, it can be tedious for sure. And I'm sure you know this.
Yeah, absolutely. But your story obviously is incredibly important. Jocelyn, as the director of this doc, did you actually know how the movie would play out before you actually started making it? Or did the story kind of lead you to different places? I mean, this documentary is incredibly fitting for the times right here, right now.
Thank you for that question, Hope. It wasn't really a linear process. And for me as a director, it never really is. I wish it was in some ways because it would make filmmaking so much easier. But we had an incredible team of producers. My editor and composer were amazing. The story, I've been saying this, but the story really kind of told me how to tell it. I like to just get out of my own way and be a vessel. And I feel like that's what I did for Mahmood's story.
Mahmood, how much input did you have in how the story was told? You know, I imagine the production took quite a long time. Maybe you can share with us that experience behind the scenes.
Well, actually, this was the first time in all of the I've done a couple of documentaries before, and this is the first experience that I've ever had where a director such as Jocelyn has involved me in the process, asking me what my opinion is. And I think that's the way it should be because, you know, they're telling your story. And so I was very grateful that she did that. And of course, there's a balance, right? Because this is what she does. And there are a lot of nuances that I'm not familiar with. And you have to also, on the flip side of that, you have to trust her as well in what she's doing. So it's a balance. But she allowed me into that world and, you know, was concerned about what I thought, what I liked, what I didn't like, and very appreciative.
I'm sure it's a very delicate balance and you take ownership of your story and your life. So I imagine it's hard to get out of your own way as well. How did the project actually come about? Was it director, producer approach you? Was it Showtime? And why the hell has it taken so long to tell the story?
This is for me or Jocelyn?
That's for whoever wants to take it.
Well, in terms of my role, I came on board after a lot of production had taken place. A lot of interviews had been filmed. There were a lot of producers already involved with the project for quite a number of months. And I was really lucky and fortunate to come on board in a time when the film needed creative direction. And I got to do just that. And Mahmood was very gracious in allowing me to share my vision of shadow boxing and various other creative approach in terms of visuals and taking it kind of outside of basketball as a metaphor for this other story that needed to be told. So it was a process and a lot of people along the way that helped it come to life.
And more for you, Mahmood, why do you think it's taken so long to tell this important historical story? And it's helped, you know, create a shift in society, in our society. It's helped educate people, but we never wanted to look at it. What is this, 27 years later?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think, of course, the story is already always been there. I think timing has a lot to do with it. Things have changed in sports with athletes, in particular the NBA, the NFL, just becoming more vocal, and just meeting people. You know, the acquaintances that you meet, timing, meeting people at the right time. I think it's well worth it because I've had something to say for a long time and there's always something going on in the world. But I think the older that I've become, more that I've read, the more experiences that I've had has allowed me, I would like to think, the ability to articulate what I've been thinking all these years much better than maybe 20 some years ago.
Mama, let's really get into this.
Okay.
You're the, in my eyes, what my husband always calls me, the tip of the spear. And when you're the tip of the spear, you take a lot of hits. And you surely did throughout your entire career. Most everybody knows your story, but you were the first athlete to not stand for the national anthem. Your constance in your faith of Islam is to be commended. But all of this, these transformations, they played out publicly. The whole transformation of your life was being played out in front of fans, in front of arenas, in front of stadiums, in the news, in the media. Everybody had something to say about it. I personally believe that there's nothing more patriotic than dissent. But as I said, you're only recognized now decades later. And when there's a social justice movement throughout our country, you were actually boycotted because of your beliefs. Do you feel cheated out of your career?
No question. And you know, what's interesting about that is when it first happened and I came back, I'm saying to myself, I'm a professional. You know, we're going to, you know, continue to do what we do. I'm going to be me. I'm going to speak my mind. But okay, we've gotten past this hurdle somewhat. And I didn't want to rush to immediately say blackball, right? Because people they're quick to want to rush, and as soon as something happens, like a white person do something to you, you quick to want to call it racist. Not everything is racist, right? Like not every moment or a person that no longer in professional sports is blackballed. But as I began to look at the patterns, right, and I'm like, wow, you know, I get traded, and this is at a time where I'm having a phenomenal year, but then my minutes began to decrease, and then on top of that, usually when I didn't play, journalists would come and they say, hey, man, why aren't you playing? And that whole year, pretty much, I was like off limits. And so these are patterns I'm looking at, all right? The diminishing of time. Now, then they come out with this special about the top free throw shooters in the NBA. And I'm...
You're the man.
They don't show me at all. Yeah, they don't show me, right? So I'm like, okay, this is interesting. And coaches are questioning. So that's when I begin to say, all right, I can see what they're doing. They're setting the stage for if we don't play him, like out of sight, out of mind, then we can justify more. So we don't know if he still has it, this issue and that issue. And so I definitely believe that. No question. I just like with Kaepernick and it ended up coming out that there was collusion that took place. This is a country club environment. You know, people talk, they know each other, you know, and just like in the world we live in, they can say, hey, don't hire him. Don't fool with him. Their interest. So I definitely believe that happened. No question. Because this is in my prime. And when I'm, look, hitting 50 and I'm hitting 30 something against Jason, I'm on a roll.
So you're standing for, I mean, I'm assuming religious freedom, obviously against oppression. And you're persecuted for it, absolutely persecuted. You lose your job ultimately at the end of the day. You're out of the NBA. You're forced to leave. You're suspended at one point. Did your teammates try to protect you?
Yeah, some of my teammates spoke out. You know, Jalen said some things, Dikembe, LaFonso, Dale Ellis, because we've been talking about this stuff all the previous year. The year that I'm suspended and so these were things that this is regular in the locker room talk. We talk about so many things, religion, politics, mm-hmm. society, culture. And so when it happened, knowing that I've been doing this all of this time and now they want to make a big fuss of it. And even players from other teams, Shaquille said something and even Jordan said something positive. Right. So but it wasn't in mass. And I wasn't surprised because usually that's the case because people are so, and I get it, I understand it, even though I don't agree with it, because it allows it to continue. But people are afraid. They're concerned about, you know, losing their job, losing their, you know, their income. Yeah, yeah. And they got us like this so much. But that's what allows for these things to continue.
Absolutely. So you're the standout high school player, standout player at LSU, one of the best rookies of all time at LSU. Shaq was quoted as saying that it was like watching God play basketball. I mean, you have incredible people on this documentary, colleagues of yours, you know, who go down as legends as a basketball player here in America. And everybody is talking about how you're one of the best players to have ever come through the NBA, that you had a style that nobody had seen, that you made it look like art, the way you moved the ball, the way your body moved. And yet you have confidence. You have a sense of swagger about you. You know you're great. You know you're good. This is your dream is to be the best player in the world. Yet you always felt, and you say this in your documentary, and I hope I don't give this away. I hope it's okay. I say this, but you said that you felt that something would always come crashing down, that you're always looking over your shoulder, or that it was too good to be true. Where did that fear come from?
You know, man, that fear of never really being able to embrace success and always feeling that something was going to happen is the language that you hear throughout your life about yourself, the images that you see on television about yourself. You know, there used to be a saying growing up, if you black, get back. If you brown, get down. If you yellow, you're mellow. If you white, you're all right, right? So the blacker you are, the worse you are. And then you're seeing television shows. I used to watch Good Times in Sanford and Son a lot. And they grew up in the same socioeconomic backgrounds that we do. And so every day we're rooting for them to make it out the ghetto. But every day something happens to kick them right back in. It seems they're so close. And so when you're constantly consuming this stuff, hearing in your out, and you don't see a lot of images of people that look like you, right? That's doing, you know what I mean, enormous things. You see a lot of the, you know, whether it's drugs or it's something negative, you tend to think that this is your story. And this is just the nature of it. And so this is why when I started looking and I say, wow, I gotta change the way I think. You know, this is why I could never embrace it. Why I felt that something was going to happen. I'm going to get hit by a car, plane going to crash because this is too good to be true. Things like this don't happen to people like me. And I would tell myself, you know, you think that, you know what? Yeah, it's going good now, but you're going to probably end up just like JJ on Good Times or Sanford and Sanford and Son, right back in the ghetto. Yeah.
Man. It's hard, man. It's hard. Yeah. It's like you can dream, but don't stay in it too long. Get in and get out. That's what America that's what America wants from a man like you. That's tough to hear. That's I can't even imagine, you know, growing up feeling that way. What do you believe the media's responsibility was through all of this? Obviously, the media is I would assume almost responsible for the amount of death threats that you received, for the burning down of your home in Mississippi. I mean, they are perpetuating it and they're not getting off of it and they're not leaving you alone. They're not leaving your teams alone and your teammates and your managers. What is their responsibility and what should it have been back then during this?
Yeah, I think you're the first one that has ever asked that question, and I'm glad you asked that question. You know, we oftentimes let the media off the hook. Right. And I think, you know, I talk about this a lot, the power of ideas, the power of language. And, you know, the media is there's so much propaganda and sensationalism that exists. And so you have this statement that I'm making, but yet you focus on the tyranny and oppression side and you don't give weight to the other side, to where there's a balance. Because, look, that stuff sells. Controversy sells. And they know this. So they have a major part in painting that picture. Most pictures that we see, or all the pictures, mm-hmm. you know, they have a major role and they should be held accountable. Look, before there's a chemical war, biological war, before there's any type of war, you first have to, before there's capitalism, before there's whatever, you have to first, before there's slavery. Right. Before there's Jim Crow, you have to develop the concept and you have to convince people that this is OK. Mm-hmm. Right. In order to justify it. And so I always say the biggest battle we have is not those things. It's not nuclear war. It's not all of that. It's not climate control. It's the battlefield of ideas. You know, and so when you lead people in the wrong direction, it's a heavy price to pay. You know, lives are affected. Millions of lives are affected. So they have a major role and will always have that role until things change.
I'm not sure we're going to get to a point where the media is really held to account, whether it's for clickbait, whether it's for some type of evil, whether it's to drag somebody through the mud. I don't see a time in the next decade where the media is going to take up and take responsibility. And a lot of that has to do with underfunding. A lot of it has to do with the lack of time to do proper research. And you're constantly trying to get out new stories. But there has to get to a point where the media is held to account. And we talk about that quite often on the show. Something I have maybe not in common with you, obviously, you grew up in Mississippi. I'm from Washington State. I went to school in Seattle, a very liberal city. I'm from the other side of the state, which is all desert, where the Hanford nuclear reactor was. It's very Republican. It's very white. My husband and I, we needed some privacy at the end of our careers. He played in the NFL as well in Seattle. And we ended up getting 60 acres in North Carolina. We chose North Carolina for a number of reasons. It's very educated. There's universities. We want the sense of freedom of raising our kids on the land. But in the end, we feel like we're in the South. And one of the things that we have noticed, you know, especially coming from the West Coast and the Northwest, is that people have a hard time that we have spoken with here in North Carolina, very rural. They have a hard time with the First Amendment, which is free speech. And they like to skip the first and go right to the second, living here in the South, which is obviously, you know, the right to bear arms. And the flags that we see the most here in North Carolina are the Don't Tread on Me and the Stars and Bars. That's what we see here in North Carolina, more so than the American flag, the Stars and Stripes. And it was absolutely eye-opening to me when I came from the Northwest and moved to North Carolina. I mean, we talk about free speech and our First Amendment, yet, and being true Americans, yet we want to divide our nation with stars and bars and Don't Tread on Me signs. And it's really opened my eyes. And I, you know, my husband has a hard time sometimes living here. Being a mixed couple, we have a hard time sometimes living here. Being a woman who might write a check and hand it to somebody who works on our property, who doesn't want to take a check from a woman or shake my hand. It's a different lifestyle. So I can only, you know, maybe you can help us understand what it was like as a young Black man growing up in Mississippi.
I mean, Mississippi is probably still one of the worst places in the South, or at least that's what's said. I mean, I almost lost the opportunity to have one of the greatest experiences in high school that I was able to have at that age at the Nike camp, because Mississippi had a rule. Even though Nike was paying, they invited me and they were paying for me to fly, to stay, food and board and all of that. And I just missed one, I think somewhere in Carolina, there was this prestigious camp also. But if it wasn't for a Dr. Dunn and me getting wind of what was happening and having to confront my high school coach, who were hiding my letters, they were hiding my letters because they wanted me to go to Mississippi school. If he wouldn't have put money into my mother's account, because we didn't have that money, I wouldn't have been able to go to Nike camp, because the state of Mississippi said I had to pay my own way, even though Nike was paying for everything. I had to pay it. And then even when I went to the camp, they said that I couldn't bring back paraphernalia that I paid for, because my high school eligibility would be, you know. So I've been, that really tore into me a little bit. I'm like, wow, man, I wonder how many other people that you destroyed their chances of, you know, upward mobility as a result of this rule, and trying to, you know, to funnel them into Mississippi schools. And so not just that, just the openness of, you know, seeing the Ku Klux Klan, you know, a known terrorist organization, you know, allowed the freedom to march down, a major 90s highway in Mississippi, and seeing those images and the questions that you have, just the relationships that you would see between, you know, Blacks and whites, and how they were always, it seems, encouraged to stand down, you know, play the game and keep your mouth shut. And those things affected me early. And it is a lasting impact on that, you know, and it took me a long time And I don't know if you ever totally rid yourself of those things. They stay with you. Perception is a powerful thing. But, and some people will never come out of it. They'll die in that state. But it bothered me to the point, man, I know I'm competitive. I'm an athlete. If I put myself through all this abuse to try to be great and all the weather conditions and playing against people and getting cut and bang, I'd be darned if I'm going to just sit back and allow this to happen. So I had to start taking steps towards changing myself. But it's tough. It's still tough. I had to move. I tried to establish a masjid, an Islamic center down there. We stayed for 4 years. And I just ended up saying, you know what? I'm just going to move to Atlanta and still do what I do from that angle. I still go back, but it's they're going to kill me down there if I stay. Because I'm just not going to be able to, I just can't keep my mouth shut.
Welcome to Georgia, my friend. Welcome to Georgia. Was anybody ever brought to justice with regard to who burned down your house?
No, somebody had given us some names. A lady at a corner store said she saw there were some people that came in the store just running their mouth about it. We had given those names to the law enforcement. Of course, they said that they were going to investigate it and to no avail. It got to the point the FBI even got involved. But nobody was ever brought to justice as a result of that. And I ended up actually in the process, because even before the burning of it, there was you could see tire tracks had knocked down when they were in the framing process. They had knocked down the garage. And then after that, there was Ku Klux Klan insignia on right before they start bricking, you know. And then after that, we get a call 4 o'clock in the morning for Sister Ivy in the community, say, hey, turn on the news, your house is burning down. I said, wow. And so we would go out, man, we would, because it's in the country. We bought 53 acres and we were trying to, you know, build a community out there. And I said, look, I'm not going out without no. So I would bring my guns on the property. I would set up target practice. We would have a barbecue. But it got to the point where I'm on the road a lot. And it's like, man, about 40 minutes or so from Gulfport. It's almost nowhere. And just to have my wife at the time and my children there and not have security, I said, you know, so that was the reason we opted to sell. But if it was just me, I'd still be there. Yeah.
I bet it'd be hard to walk the streets. And I think I'd be looking, staring everybody down in their eyes, being like, was it you? Was it you?
Right.
Did he flinch? Did he
You're
flinch?
Right.
He was too nervous to look
You're
at me.
Right.
Did you see him look at me? I think you wouldn't know who to trust. So I'm glad you're out of Mississippi. You mentioned in the documentary that it was life-changing when you went to Mecca. How?
You know, that was my first time, I think, ever traveling overseas. And just after becoming, really, it's not just the Mecca experience. It was life-changing, just embracing Islam. You know, I was asked, well, what is it about it? And from the first day until now, every time I pick up the Quran and I engage it, not just read it for the sake of reading, but I engage it, I ask questions, I seek like a deeper meaning. No matter what the issue is, it has never ceased to satisfy my curiosity to answer my question. And so it's been that way since day one. And going to Mecca and experiencing, you know, one of my heroes, Malcolm X, you know, and his experience with that, and just the people that you meet, knowing that the prophet, you know, took those same steps, and the prophet before him, Ibrahim, and even this Ethiopian black woman who birthed one of the prophets, Ismail, you know, and the struggle that she had between Safa and Marwa, and understanding all of that, man, and just to look what came out of that in terms of, you know, billions of people embracing this faith, it just puts things in perspective for you. Yeah.
Jocelyn, I do want to know, what was the most important lesson that you guys, both of you, that you hope people take away from this documentary?
It's a great question. I mean, I've talked about it a bit, but Mahmoud's story is just one of courage and walking through fires and literally, physically, those fires as well as spiritual fires, mental, emotional fires. I think Mahmood's journey of facing that courageously and fearlessly and transmuting it and still shining his light, that should be, I think, an example for all of us, that when things are difficult, you know, we can look at Mahmood's story and remember that Mahmood was able to face all of that and still shine even brighter. And I guess they say, you know, stars shine brightest in the dark, but Mahmood's shadows, and that's why I use the shadow boxing motif a bit in the film that I concepted for it, is I saw part of Mahmood's journey through the lens of shadow boxing as a metaphor for that kind of inner struggle of facing those shadows and finding that light, which I think Mahmood's story is a great example of.
Amen. Mahmood, what do you want people to get from this?
You know, everybody has a story, and everybody's story is compelling. And we all share as human beings similarities, which is why I think storytelling is like a multi-billion dollar industry, right? No, there's always something to gain from it. You know, people are struggling, right? So much in the world, whether it be their faith, whether it be mental illness. Never in the history, I believe, ever, you've had so many young people, right, with mental illnesses and wanting to commit suicide. And so, you know, and then, you know, so even me growing up with Tourette syndrome and the labeling industry, right, how we're labeled disease and disorder. And then, you know, you have a book by Malcolm Gladwell talk about David and Goliath and basically how we perceive advantages and disadvantages, the many contributions that people with dyslexia, or you look at my case, you know, I would have been counted out if you just buy into the labels, right? Oh, you got a problem and you got this. But, you know, I believe that God gives us, he doesn't give us a burden that we can't bear. And I believe that everything that we've been given, he's going to challenge us with things, but these challenges are meant to elevate us, not meant to destroy us. And so those type of lessons, growing up in poverty, you know, not having a father, which a lot of us who grew up in the ghetto, we have those similar stories. Having Tourette syndrome or whatever disorder, or whatever, how you want to label it, how to navigate through that. So then I think storytelling is such too, that if you're not leaving people with questions, like, you know, you want to leave people with asking more questions, and you want to leave people with, you know, innate, you know, thinking, like, you know what I mean? How do I say it? I just want people to think, and I want to leave them with questions to dig deeper. Some people will they'll read a book or they'll look at a film and they'll look at it at its surface level. For some people, and they teach you this later on, you know, in English or what have you, in literature, that a lot of the message, sometimes most of the message, is what's in between the lines. And so just getting them to think and to ask questions. And this is what we're hoping for.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of life lessons throughout this documentary. I wanted to ask you, before I let you go here, what do you feel about the athletes this day and age? You see so many athletes standing for something, whether it's police brutality, whether it's LGBTQ rights, whether it's equal pay, whether it was, you know, the World Cup being held in Qatar, and the human rights violations. So you're seeing athletes more and more stand for something. It's been popularized to a point, yep, where I'm wondering how much we're actually getting done. You see a lot of athletes on the mic. You see a lot of athletes wearing the shirts. But obviously true change means one must make true sacrifice. So I want to get kind of your outlook on the many athletes that are attempting to take a stance for something. And then also I want to get your take on Colin Kaepernick. Many of us heard more about your story after Kaepernick began to kneel.
You hit it on the nose. It's a challenge in this day and age, but more so I think in our day and age, because you have social media. And activism pays well, right? For certain people, right? And some people have found out a way to monetize it. You know, Richard Itten, a political scientist, I use this quote all the time because it really resonates with me and I think it's very relevant. He said that he cautions viewing protest as inherently revolutionary because once it becomes routine and accepted, it's easily molded and shaped into the elite hegemonic understanding of things, which means they're able to capsule it, they're able to put it on shirts, they're able to, you know, monetize it, and then it loses its thrust. You know, Dr. Harry Edwards, you know, talked about, and I think social media has changed so much that it's easy for people just to put something down, right? Or to type something and now they're an activist. I don't even label, you know, I don't even label myself, you know, as that. I'm just, look, man, it's something I got to say. I'm going to say it. It's something I got to do. I'm going to do it. And I leave that up to other people. But it's good, but it's also, it's challenging and it's bad because of what you said, it's become so popularized. It loses its thrust, you know, because so many people are doing it. And a lot of them are obviously just like nonprofit organizations, right? Doing it for the wrong reasons. Yeah. Doing it for the wrong reasons. Yeah. But I do believe that if you're not offending people that deserve to be offended, you're doing something wrong. I really believe that.
Yeah.
So it's good that it's a new era. More athletes are talking out. We need that. But we got to be careful of allowing corporations to come in and capitalize and monetize off that. Because like even with, you know, and I'm going to throw this out there. Like I had a concern when Cap came out, right? And he took this position. And I was saying to myself, not everybody, look, it's not for everybody to be on stage talking. That's not everybody's thing. Some people like, you know, to spend their wealth on the under for people. There are many ways to do this. But I know how the human mind works too often, that he comes out, he initiates this, and then all of a sudden, now you don't hear from him, right? Not that he's not doing anything, but the mind of the people, right? They're going to, and if when people see you, and when they see you, if it's capitalizing on something, like, oh, it's a shoe coming out, it's a movie coming out, is this? Now they're looking at, oh, he's monetized, he's capitalizing on this, but we don't hear him speaking here. Not that he's not doing it, but it's dangerous and you don't want to lose the people that way. But this is sometimes, even when it's not our intention to do so, they trap us into that and we become that, like, oh, God dang, they set me up. Man, most every time now I'm doing something, they're selling this product. That wasn't my intention. And now the people have this view of me as opposed to that. And so I'm always trying to be aware of that. Like when people say, hey, Mahmoud, you know, what if the NBA apologized? Well, apologies aren't enough. Families were hurt. People lost income. But you can't just come to me. There are many people before me that are still living that were affected for whatever reason. I'm just not going to sit here and no. What about Craig Hodges? What about this? What about this person? So I'm big on, like, look, man, if you're going to do something for me, then are you going to do something for them too? Or, look, I don't want you to do anything for me because I know how that's going to look in the minds of the public. I'd rather just, man, look, I'll be okay. I'll just keep eating what I eat and living how I'm living. I'd rather go out like that than go out where the perception of me is, wow, he sold out. You know, he did this. And so it's a very... ooh, delicate balance, you know what I mean, to keep when you're in that field.
Man, I'm gonna quote Encanto for you guys. I have 2.5-year-old mm-hmm. twins. I watch Encanto a lot. But Jocelyn, you said often that the star shines brightest in the dark. And I'm gonna throw this one at you. Stars don't shine, they burn. it takes a lot of self-sacrifice, as we spoke about, to really create change in the world. And I do think you're a true star, my friend. I'll end with this. You stated that you would rather live on the street with nothing than give up your values. Mm-hmm. I want everybody who is listening to this show to recognize that that is true sacrifice. Mamoun, Jocelyn, thank you for being with me today.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I appreciate you.
Hope Solo Speaks is part of the SiriusXM Sports Podcast Network. If you enjoyed this episode and want to hear more, please give a 5-star rating and leave a review. Subscribe today wherever you stream your podcasts.
SiriusXM Podcasts.